Well, thank you very much. Is the microphone on? Can you hear me? Okay, great. Okay, well, we've been hearing a little bit about the X-ray side and our diagnostics for heating and relativistic shocks. And so I actually wanted to do something maybe a little less ambitious, which is to study the heating and collisionless shocks that are non-relativistic and to actually talk about the optical and UV diagnostics of this. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with these fine collaborators here, and my work here would not be possible without their contribution. So I wanted to begin first by just being really pedantic and reminding everyone of how the non-relativistic shock in an ideal gas strong shock, how that works. From the conservation of momentum and mass and energy, we understand a plane parallel shock as being a supersonic disturbance where you have one hot gas penetrating into a colder one, and you have a pre-shock density and a temperature characterizing that gas, and the particles have a mass m. And by these jump conditions, if the shock is really strong, then behind the shock, your density should rise by a factor of 4. And the temperature behind the shock front for a given particle with species with mass m should be 3/16 mv². So it should go proportional to the mass. And the bulk velocity of the post-shock flow as observed by someone at rest relative to it will be about 3/4 the shock speed. And basically, by these jump conditions, then this establishes a minimum for the electron heating, and it establishes a maximum for the various ion heatings. And so these various ratios, temperature ratios, should go like the mass ratios. Now, the interstellar medium I'm speaking of is the really low density medium between these this value of density and with these shock speeds between about 100 and probably higher than that, and 10,000 kilometers per second. And with these conditions, generally your mean free path for energy exchange in Coulomb collisions between charged particles can be anywhere from on the order of an astronomical unit all the way up to hundreds of parsecs, depending on how dilute and how hot the gas is. And so the gas is effectively collisionless, and so there's the problem arises then how do you even maintain a shock front transition if you can't heat up the particles within one simple mean free path. And the understood way to get around this is that MHD waves and turbulence, in the cases of high Mach number shocks, they assume the role of shock collisions, of collisions. And so essentially what happens is the stream kinetic energy of the particles entering the shock gives rise to plasma instabilities, which in turn excite waves, and there's heating. And so you have this indirect process where the plasma instabilities and the magnetic fields generated by the waves heat up the particles. And so the shock front thickness is characterized typically to be on the order of a Larmor radius for the ion that is the predominant carrier of the momentum for the flow. And so as just an example here, I'm showing some data that was taken with the SOHO instrument for a coronal mass ejection. And there's a measurement here of the velocity as for the instrument as ahead of the shock. The coronal mass ejection, and behind it there's a jump there, and there's activity behind the shock front, and there's also a jump in density and in the other parameters as well. So these things have been, collisionless shocks do exist, and they are in the solar wind. Now, I wanted to list for you a few of the properties of collisionless shocks. Since the ions, I guess I'm referring mainly in this case to the protons in the ISM, have most of the flow energy, then whatever plasma instabilities and waves are excited in the shock front will typically have wavelengths that are resonant with the Jouler radii of these ions. And in addition to that, the heating is going to be anisotropic. You can actually get heating parallel to the magnetic field that is different than perpendicular to it. And so in principle, these shocks are very complicated. And another thing is that this wave heating is intrinsically non-thermal, so you don't actually officially expect a Maxwellian distribution to be established among these various charged particle species at the shock front. And this has actually been observed in the solar wind, and I will show you an example of that. And the other thing, too, is that it's known, well, it's predicted both from theory and it is observed in a solar wind, that the degree of this collisionless heating in the shock front for the various particle species is really sensitive to the shock parameters. It depends, of course, on the shock speed. It depends on the angle between the shock front and the magnetic field. And it also depends on this quantity called beta, which is the ratio of the upstream thermal energy of the gas to the magnetic energy in the gas. And so based on this description, the quasi perpendicular shocks, ones going perpendicular to the magnetic field, are very different from those that are running parallel to it. And in this whole situation, the degree of electron-ion and the ion-ion equilibration is essentially a free parameter. All you know is how much energy from the shock goes into thermal energy, but you don't know how it's distributed. And so the ratio of the temperatures for any two species will go from a value in proportional to their mass. It can range from that all the way down to or up to 1. And this understanding exactly how this works in these collision of shocks is a fundamental problem of plasma physics of collision of shocks. And so if your temperature is, in principle then, if your temperatures, I'm showing one example over here, if your temperatures are, if your particles are heated up only according to the jump conditions and they get mass proportional heating, then if you use a relationship from Spitzer, plugging in temperatures, you calculate how long would it take for those two different ionic species with different charges, how long would it take for them to equilibrate just by Coulomb collisions behind the shock. And you actually find that this number actually turns out, even when you plug in numbers here, it turns out to be on the order of thousands of years. And so if the ions start out like not hardly heated at all at the shock front, they're going to stay different. They're not going to approach an equilibrium really quickly. And in addition to that, the equilibration time is older than the ages of supernova remnants that you observe these shocks in. And so these conditions, they occur mainly, the conditions are met for the adiabatic, or that, by that I mean non-cooling or non-radiative shocks found in supernova remnants. And so this is why they are very interesting to study for understanding the shock physics. Now, non-radiative collisional shocks, they occur, of course, in the solar wind. I'm just quoting a couple of typical numbers over here. But the one big difference between supernova remnant shocks and those in the solar wind is that if you define the magnetosonic Mach number, which is the ratio of the shock speed to the quadrature mean of the alphane and sound speeds, then you end up with a very different range of Mach numbers for solar wind shocks as opposed to supernova remnants. For the solar wind, the values, and these are both predicted and of course measured by spacecraft, is these Mach numbers go between 1.5 and 3.0 typically, and it can go up to as values as high as 20 when the shock speeds are very high. But in supernova remnants, which propagate into a rather low temperature gas and with a B field of about 3 microgauss in the ISM, these Mach numbers can range anywhere from 20 up to 300 or even higher than that. And so you are looking at a very different regime of shock wave physical parameters. And in this regime, the shock transition is expected to be highly turbulent and very unsteady, and that the actual heating at the shock front and the structure of it is very much influenced and controlled by the population of ions that are reflected upstream ahead of the shock as the gas enters the shock front. And this is something that is mentioned in some of the classic monographs on collisionless shocks, and it is observed in the solar wind. Now, the place where we can actually study this kind of physics in a reasonably good level of detail are places where you have one of these non-radiative shocks with a reasonably good spatial resolution, relatively flat, simple geometry. This is, of course, not really simple, but it's simple enough that some useful information can be gathered from it. The study of these shocks, these non-radiative shocks in the UV, X-ray, and optical is a very good way for trying to measure the relative ratios of the various temperatures in these shocks at the shock front, and also, of course, to look in the line profiles and look for departures from a Maxwellian velocity distribution. Now, of course, in these cases, the post-shock gas is hot, and ions are mostly stripped, no cooling, and so you don't have cooling actually changing your temperature variation behind the shock. It is all determined by what happens at the shock front and the post-shock Coulomb collisions. And basically, because the Coulomb collisions are infrequent, the shock structure retains a certain memory of its initial condition right at the shock transition, and so this makes it very useful. And so some of the objects which I'm going to list here are ones that occur in galaxy and in the LMC and SMC where these kinds of studies can be done. And here I'm showing optical images. One is the northeast corner of the Cygnus loop, where the whole rest of the remnant is actually much larger than the screen, but there are certain portions where the shock is propagating into partially neutral gas and is producing emission that is useful for diagnosing the shock conditions. And here's the other case, RCW86. Another galactic remnant where it's encountering in some places along the rim very dense clouds and you have cooling going on. Those aren't good for studying the properties of collisionless shocks, but these thin filaments here where the gas is not cooling and it's still in relatively pristine condition. Those are excellent sites for studying the shock physics. And so what happens when one of these shocks propagates into a partially neutral gas? Well, it turns out that since the shock transition, as I mentioned, is determined by MHD turbulence and magnetic fields interactions require charged particles, if you're a neutral particle, you're not going to see the shock front. You'll just sail right through it. And so the slow ambient H1, if one of these shocks is going into neutral gas, it is destroyed very rapidly in a very thin ionization layer behind the shock. And so there's thicknesses on the order of maybe a few hundred astronomical units or less. And what happens is that as this gas is overrun, sure, it's being ionized away and is disappearing, but also you form a second population of neutrals that are hot. You form these by charge exchange. Behind the shock, the hot protons come in and steal an electron off of the cold neutrals, and they generate these fast neutrals. And both those cold neutrals and the fast neutrals both can emit Balmer line emission, and so you get a double line profile here, one broad one that has a width that is proportional to the post-shock proton temperature and is very useful for determining that, and a narrow one, which is just that cold population that's been excited. And so the prediction of these two components and the discussion of them is something was done by Chevalier et al. In 1980 and has been elaborated since then by the work of Chris Smith and my own work. One of the predictions of this theory, too, is that because the gas is not cooling, the emission that you're seeing behind the shock front is at most been material that's been compressed by at most a factor of 4. That's the fast neutrals. And so the optical and UV emission from these shocks is generally very faint, and they're very hard to detect, and they require very deep integrations to get good spectra. And here's an example of a theoretical model for one of these shocks. The shock front is located right here, and then we pass downstream. And here's how the populations of the two particle species evolve behind the shock front. Your neutrals ionize away, your cold ones, but then you pick up a fast neutral population that it eventually starts to ionize away and disappear too. So your broad component comes from this big guy here, and your narrow component comes from this one over here. And the relative proportions of those actually does scale with the relative amount of heating at the shock front between the electrons and protons. And so that is making it a very good diagnostic. It's coming from a region where these two temperatures, it's very sensitive to what these temperatures are. And so here is an HST image, just to bring home the point that these zones are very thin. An HST image by Blair et al. From the northeastern corner of the Cygnus Loop, where you see multiple tangencies along a line of sight of the shock wave, and you can see it's very thin. The shock front gets down to about 1 WPK pixel, so you're looking at a very thin ionization zone, and the spectra there are very useful for our diagnostics. Now, some characteristics of these that are useful for us is that they're dominated by the Balmer lines. They call them Balmer-dominated spectra. Here's an example from the northeastern corner of the Cygnus Loop, where we see a broad H-alpha line and a narrow one, and you see the same thing on H-beta and H-gamma, H-delta, and the rest are just incomplete night sky subtraction. So there is very little other line emission. And what is useful about this is that if you take the ratio of the flux in the broad component and divide it by the flux in the narrow component, that actually tells you something about the shock speed and the equilibration, because the broad component flux is proportional to how many fast neutrals you've generated, i.e. the charge exchange rate here, whereas the narrow component emission goes like the ionization rate, and the ratio of the two is sensitive to both the shock speed and the equilibration at the shock front. And another thing that is useful is that the shape of this broad Balmer line, whether it has wings or whether it's Maxwellian or anything, it really reflects the distribution of the protons that are coming in and stealing off the electrons. And so if those are non-Maxwellian, you'll see it in the profile of these neutrals as well. And finally, there is another extra neat little thing, which is the broad Balmer line can be shifted depending on the viewing angle to the shock. If you're looking at an edge-on shock, the flow of the post-shock gas is perpendicular to your line of sight. And so your broad component is centered on your narrow component. But if you're looking at this face-on, these fast neutrals that you've generated, since they came from the proton distribution, they have the bulk velocity of the post-shock gas, and so they're shifted by 3/4 the shock speed. And whereas the narrow component just has the distribution of the pre-shock gas, it just sits right there. So this variation, if you're looking completely face down one of these shocks, this shift here between the broad and the narrow is exactly 3/4 the shock speed. And of course, whatever your viewing angle is, it's usually like a cosine theta term in there, where theta is your angle to the line of sight, and so on. right? If it's 10, it will be different, and that's actually, and of course it makes it, the fact that that if you're looking at one of these face-on is so faint, it makes the detection of such broad emission very difficult. But we have actually been involved in one of those projects that John Raymond is actually currently involved in. But yes, face-on in a Cygnus loop to look for extra compression there. Over here, yes, this actually, I can't believe I went over this. This is one of the knots in Tycho, often in the middle of the bomber filaments. There's a knot there that is partially face on, and that shift there is, it implies a viewing angle of, I believe, about 60 degrees from face on, and the shift here is about 550 kilometers per second from rest. And because it's redshifted, you're looking at a knot that was hit on the far side. The shock has hit that and driven a bomber-dominated shock into that. And so this is one of the places where you very clearly see it. It's oftentimes hard to see because the limb brightening goes way down as you look at one of these shocks more face-on. Now, here's a way that we can use this information to actually try and estimate what the equilibration and shock speed is together for various shocks. There's a two-step process in which you can do this. If you see a bomber-dominated shock, you have your broad, you have your narrow component, you can measure the full width half maximum of the broad H-alpha line, and that will narrow the range of shock speeds that you consider in when you're trying to compute what the shock parameters are. Once you've got that range of shock speeds, each one of those shock speeds corresponds to a different equilibration. So then you run a shock model with those combinations of shock speed and equilibration, and then try to reproduce the broad to narrow flux ratio. And whichever one reproduces that will then tell you you have enough information now to determine both the equilibration and the shock speed together. And so here is a plot with showing an example of where you do this, where for a given full width half maximum, you observe, say, 1,000 kilometers per second. You then draw a line straight over here, and then for this equilibration where it's minimal, you draw a line down here, and that's where your shock speed is. And if you're all the way over here, then you come here and read down what your shock speed is over there. And so you have a range of speeds and parameters that you can run your models with. And so this is something that I applied to a few cases, and here's a few where we've determined these parameters together. And for the northeastern Cygnus loop, we determined shock speeds. We narrowed it down to between 300 and 400, and this is primarily dominated by the uncertainty in the broad component width measurement. This is the dominant source of uncertainty. And of course, your atomic data, which is your cross-sections are not known to much better than 20%. But for the northeast Cygnus loop, we were able to determine that the electron to proton temperature ratio at the shock front by collisionless heating is somewhere between 0.8 and 1. So it comes very close to equilibrating the electrons and proton temperatures. When you go up to higher shock speeds between 600 and 650, this is RCW86, that drops to about 30%. And in Tycho, at these high speeds, it drops to less than or equal to 0.1, somewhere between 0 and 0.1. And for SN1006, it's even lower. It's less than or equal to 0.07. And so what this seems to imply is that the electrons are receiving a smaller and smaller fraction of the shock energy as you go to higher and higher shock speeds. And so this is telling you something about what the heating at the shock front is doing, what the collision of the shock is doing. And this sort of trend has also been observed by doing a combined optical and X-ray analysis. And this is something that Carol will tell us about tomorrow for the case of DEML71 and for several other cases for combined optical and X-ray. Here's an example of where now we can actually measure the ion-ion equilibration, where we choose that same filament, that section up in the corner of a Cygnus loop, and we take, this isn't too terribly visible here, but if you take the fuse aperture and you step it at the shock front and then you take it in increments behind the shock, you can actually get spectra as a function of position behind the shock front there and actually measure the flux in 06 and the line width and watch and see what it is doing as you go farther behind the shock. And the prediction here is, the theoretical prediction is that if your electrons are equal in temperature to the oxygen, then they should be very hot and your oxygen zone should rise up and die away very quickly. So your peak in your O6 flux behind the shock is going to happen quickly and then die down quickly. Whereas if the electrons are not very well heated, then it takes a while for them to heat up by Coulomb collisions, and eventually the O6 reaches a peak farther behind the shock than it would otherwise, and then it dies down. And so by the spatially resolved type of analysis, you can do this. In principle, you can do it for O6, you can do it for the broad Lyman beta and Lyman gamma lines using Fuse, HST, or HUT. And you can do the same thing for carbon 4 and nitrogen 5, provided you have the bandpass, which of course we no longer have now that STIS is gone. But this basically allows you to simultaneously probe the electron ion and the ion ion equilibration. So suppose you have one of these bomber filaments here, and you have enough, you have a low enough extinction there that you can do this ultraviolet study. Then what you do is first you constrain the shock speed by doing this Bratz-Narrow ratio study for H alpha and determining, you know, what your equilibration and shock speed is for the electrons and protons and the shock speed. And then what you do is then you say, okay, what's the spatial variation of these ion line emissivities from one of these species behind the shock? And of course, these are all being produced in the zone behind the shock that is ionizing up, and so there's no cooling affecting these lines, and they tend to be rather faint. And so when you look at these lines, when comparing one ion line with another one, actually this should be flipped. If they're unequilibrated, then all the line widths would be pretty much equal to one another. Whereas if they are actually equilibrated, then it'll be in the ratio of the square root of the masses. So the helium line will be one half the width of the proton, full width half maximum, and oxygen will be one quarter of that, and carbon will be square root of 12 down from that. And so this is something you can very easily compare. And so these Fuse observations of the Cygnus loop from Raymond et al. 2003, they give the ratio of the oxygen to proton temperature to be somewhere between 1 and 2.5. So this isn't 16, it's 2.5. So this is telling us that the oxygen ions and the protons have come very close to establishing temperature equilibrium right at the shock front. And this is interesting because this is also very similar to what we were getting for the electrons versus proton. They also have close to the same temperature. So it looks like all the species to within a factor of two or so receive equal heating, we come up to equal temperatures very close to the shock front. And so this is telling us something about, for this shock speed or this Mach number, this is what's happening in the shock. I wanted to spend a few moments talking about how one can use one of these line profiles to try and look for departures from a Maxwellian distribution. There have been in situ observations of a solar wind plasma between 0.3 and 1.5 AU was one number I saw, that they show when they measure the electron distributions, they almost always show a more or less Maxwellian core, but then they show these Lorentzian-like tails on them. They call them a kappa distribution. They see these in the solar wind, and of course they are also seen with the ions as well. And another distribution that is sometimes seen in the solar wind are these flat top distributions where you have something that looks symmetric, but the top is squashed, and this is seen with electron distributions. And so one of the things that this can do is if you have these long tails on the lines, these can actually enhance your collisional ionization rates for all of your species and the excitation rates, because it is these tail ions, these electrons on the tail that are doing all the exciting. And one of the things that is true if you compute it in the non-radiative shocks I was just talking about, the time scale required for electrons to equilibrate with each other and to establish a Maxwellian distribution is generally pretty short. It's much less than the age of the Renman, and so the electrons should more or less should either be close to a Maxwellian or will have something that looks somewhat like this. But with the protons and with the other ions, the collision time between them is much longer because they move slower. They're bigger and more massive, and so that the time required for the protons to establish a Maxwellian and for the ions to establish a Maxwellian, each one among themselves, actually is larger than the age of the Renman by Coulomb collisions if you compute it. And so basically, the fact that we're seeing, and here's one case for Tycho, not G. The fact that we're seeing this broad component line on here, this is a proxy for the proton distribution here, the fact that it looks so close to Maxwellian to the best of our ability to measure it is telling you something very interesting about what's happening at the shock front, because this is not Coulomb collisions that are doing this. This is collisionless heating is somehow establishing a Maxwellian very close to the shock front. And so to the best that we can tell, now of course we haven't gone deep enough to really try and pull out these tails, but as best we can tell from looking at our line profiles, they do appear to be very well fit by Gaussian function. And so further observations at higher signal to noise may show otherwise, but of course that would require very deep integrations, because this, comparing this peak down to here, we're talking about a factor of 1,000 or more in difference in counts, and so you'd really have to go deep on this to really find it, but it's a worthy thing to do. So here's one case where we can do further study of the equilibration, and this is for SN1006, and this here is a Chandra mosaic showing on the soft band, showing the red and showing the shocks, and you have the TEB gamma rays being produced, actually synchrotron X-rays, TEB electrons along the corner here. But in this corner over here, where you see a lot of thermal emission, this is where there's a prominent bomber line filament where the shock is going into partially neutral gas, and that's a very good site for taking spectra and doing this sort of shock physics. And the spectrum of this, just showing an extreme close-up, shows this nice broad H-alpha line with the narrow on top of it, but it also shows, and it doesn't show so well over here, but there's also neutral helium emission being produced here, and we have also some limit on the helium-246-86. And it turns out that if you include the uncertainty in the fluxes of these and the detections, you can actually learn something about the equilibration even from these really faint lines. You know, these lines, of course, are excited in the same zone where all the H-alpha is being produced. And what we found was, in trying to model the ratio of the helium-1 to helium-2 line ratio, and here's the range implied by observations, that we really needed to have very low equilibration at the shock front in order to reproduce that line ratio. And that, along with our actual broad-to-narrow ratios in H-alpha, gave us this estimate that the ratio of the electron to proton temperatures is somewhere between 1 over 2,000 and 0.07. And the shock speed comes out close to 2,900 kilometers per second. And this is the only place in SN1006 that is actually bright enough that we can really do this study with, whereas a lot of these really neat, interesting places around here, which would line up with the X-ray emission, the bright stuff is just too faint. We can't actually... Yeah. That is exactly right, and this is something I've been noting for quite a while now, that there's an anti-correlation between where you see the bomber filaments and where you see the bright non-thermal X-ray emission. And indeed, it would appear that the presence of the neutrals there is actually suppressing efficient cosmic ray acceleration at those sites. There are some somewhat intermediate cases, perhaps in Tycho, where you do have intermediate brightness in the X-rays and the optical, but yes, that's... Maybe just so you're a time scale argument then for the. I hadn't thought of that. Okay, well that's also another thing working against us seeing the non-thermal emission there. I wanted to quickly point out some of the UV observations here. In 1995 and 96, there were observations with the Hopkins ultraviolet telescope of this region up in the corner here, and here's what the slit looked like on the sky. And the material enters in through this way, and there's a zone behind there where the O6 emission is produced and the other ions as well. And the spectrum is right here, and you have some very bright air glow lines, and unfortunately O6 and nitrogen-5 are blended with it. But you do nevertheless detect them, their emission on the wing there, and you also see helium-2 and carbon-4. And so this has actually allowed Raymond et al. And then Martin Lamming and now Kelly Korak and her work to try and estimate, compare the line widths in these various ions and see how equilibrated were they at the shock front by collisionless heating. And the fuse spectrum here, a recent one taken from this zone, and here's the aperture again, almost the same as Hutt, shows the O6 and Lyman beta to be very strongly blended together. They have to be deblended, but then there's also a contribution from interstellar absorption there. But when you skip over that and actually fit the lines together, you end up with measurements of the line width that are very useful for determining something about the equilibration at the shock front. And so one of the results here that's been found is that if you look at the helium-2 and carbon-4 and O6 line widths, O7 I think is actually, this has changed since this got published, but helium-2 and carbon-4 and O6, there's this tendency here where this number over here is how many percent of the shock jump condition value your temperature is observed to be. So helium is observed to be 80% of its value from the jump conditions, and carbon-4 is observed to be 80, and O6 is only 50%. And so one possibility is that it seems that as you, when you're looking in this shock, that the higher mass ions are actually losing more of their energy to equilibration than the lower mass ions. And of course, if this is true, then this is actually different than what is seen in the solar wind. And so it's something that is certainly very interesting and needs to be repeated for other cases where the shock speed and equilibration have been pretty well constrained. And how long do I have?
You're almost
off. Okay. All right. So here, this is my last slide before conclusions. So there was a recent. I had this open my mouth. Recently, we've obtained some fuse spectra of some bomber remnants in the LMC, and here's the fuse aperture. And we just pointed down the middle and took some spectra of these. And just to show you, in DEM71, we're observing face-on and rear-on, if you will, emission. And there's a bright detection of the Lyman beta line from the neutrals, the same ones that are producing the H alpha. And O6 lines as well with absorption. And the line widths here, even though we have to use a geometric model to disentangle the varying shock angles to the line of sight, nevertheless, the O6 and Lyman beta line widths are very different. And it's implying that there is some heating going on of the O6 ions beyond, there is some energy loss by them beyond what is just from the jump conditions. And in 0519 here, there is another similar case where you have broad Lyman beta and it is blended with O6. And the fits over there give us a value of the broad Lyman beta width of about 3,000, and the O6 line width, even though that's larger, there's a very big error bar on that, and so it's consistent with the ratio here of just mass proportional heating. And finally, here with 0509, the number I've been getting has just been something from a limit here, because we actually don't detect the O6. This Lyman beta line is so broad, it's 3,700, that we can only get some limit on it, but it's consistent with the oxygen just being equal to its jump condition value. So, okay, here's our conclusions. So our current result here, the big one, is that it appears that as the shock speed increases, the thermal energy of the shock is less and less well distributed between the various ionic species, and it asymptotically approaches mass proportional heating. So here is all these equilibrations I was talking about, electron to proton temperature ratio at the shock front. Here's what it does as shock speed increases. It definitely drops. And this anticorrelation between equilibration and shock speed looks very much like what is seen in the solar wind, where you see this anticorrelation between the Mach number and the temperature. And as best we can tell, the proton distributions that are stealing off the electrons from the cold neutrals are following a Maxwellian distribution. I don't know what this implies about the plasma turbulence at the shock front, but it seems to be saying something about it. And then there's also this observation that it seems like the higher the mass of the ion, the more it loses energy to the other particles in this collisionless heating, in the case of SN1006. And finally, this is of course something that everyone wants to know, is what does this imply about the cosmic ray injection mechanism, because these heating processes are the same things that are injecting things in the cosmic ray acceleration. And finally, we would like to calibrate this so we can actually predict the equilibration once we have a Mach number measured for each shock. We would like to actually take that and use it for our future simulations. Thank you.
I think there's one thing you can say for sure about the injection mechanism, and that is if you start off with cold electrons and they take quite a while to heat up as they're swept downstream, they will never be injected into diffusive shock acceleration. And the one thing we know for sure is that we're accelerating relativistic electrons in these shocks.
So you need to have some kind of heating right there.
They need to be heated instantly.
Okay. Okay, so then I suppose then an interesting thing to do would be to find some way to observe one of these non-radiative shocks where there is no neutral gas present, observe maybe carbon-4 and O6, and then see what's going on there, and are you seeing the same trend? And chances are, from what you're saying, we may not see the same thing. It would be, sounds very interesting.
Those images of 1006 you shown, is any observational indication as to how the magnetic field can be oriented?
The only indication that I know of is Brian Gensler did a study of various supernova remnants for his thesis, and he was noting the orientation between the galactic magnetic field and the supernova remnants. And for SM1006, the place where you see the efficient acceleration on the edges there, it is going definitely perpendicular to the galactic magnetic field, whereas in the north, it's closer to being parallel. But of course, it never is completely parallel. There's always some angle. I'm sorry? The finding has been, it seems to be, the finding is that whenever you have a magnetic field orientation known relative to the shock front, the places where it's perpendicular seems to be more efficient than where it's not perpendicular. So this is SN1006. I don't know if there are other cases. There may actually be some. Yeah, from the theoretical argument is that if it's the cosmic ray acceleration. Well, it's interesting because for a number of years when I was reading up on cosmic ray acceleration, there was always a discussion of, well, if the shock moves parallel to the field, it's easier for particles to escape upstream and to have the scattering take place. But then Jacopi came with this picture that it's perpendicular. And I don't know if anyone has done anything with that since then, but theoretically, it would seem like it should be the opposite, but I don't really know if there are cases that I don't think we know enough about the magnetic field orientation to say for sure if it goes.
In partial response to. In response to what Don Ellison said, in Cassiopeia A, where we see stuff that we can interpret as synchrotron emission from cosmic ray electrons around the blast wave. We see no evidence of collisionless electron heating in the thermal plasma behind the blast wave. That's about 5,000 kilometers per second, and it's in line with your plot up there. So this is definitely a puzzle.
Very well. Yeah, this is, I think probably one of the best studies to do would be to find a remnant where you have a non-radiative shock, it's in a region of low enough extinction, and it's close enough you can do a proper motion measurement and you know the distance to it, so you can definitely nail down the shock speed without the need to use this broad Lyman beta and H-alpha line. If you know the shock speed, then you can detect the carbon 4 and 06 and the other ions and see what they're doing behind the shock front and how equilibrated are they, and see whether it agrees with what you have when you have neutral gas present, and that would be really the definitive test, and then you could say, but those kinds of studies are difficult. I don't think there are many objects out there. Probably in the LMC would be where you'd find them, where you can do this kind of study. Now, of course, I'm not mentioning X-ray observations at all, and that's critical, but that's something that Kara's going to talk about.
Yeah, I was just going to make the comment. It's a nice non-radiative shock in SN1987A, where you can see the emission coming from the reverse shock,
right,
where the shock velocity is quite well determined at something around 12,000 kilometers per second or so. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've thought about trying what information is available there, if one could say something about the electron temperature
LED.
Or amount of equilibration that's going on there.
Well, I wonder because Ellie Michael published a paper a few years ago where he was, I think it was the HETG, LETG spectrum of 1987A, and he was finding that the continuum he was seeing there was requiring a very low heating of the electrons, but I don't know whether he was seeing that same region where that Balmer and Lyman alpha line is produced. I think it's maybe a different part of the. Right, and so that it makes it harder to tell. You don't know where it's coming. This is why I was emphasizing earlier to find a place where you can really isolate a portion of the blast wave. And one of the good things about the optical and UV study too, though, is that see if you observe these in the X-rays, the electrons, once the gas gets ionized behind the shock, it's going to emit in the X-rays and emit, and you're seeing gas that was ionized like thousands of years ago. Maybe the integrated history of the remnant is what you're seeing in the X-rays. So that can actually confuse your interpretation a little bit. It becomes more model dependent. But if you have something like that Cygnus loop shock, where it's just one sheet and the remnant is large enough that you can separate everything from one another, then the UV emission behind the shock, it rises and it drops and it goes away and never comes back. So there's no confusing it with, you don't have to know the previous history of the remnant unless it hit something really dense recently in order to
When you see the eons getting colder behind the shock, then how do you know that the energy goes to electrons or other eon species rather than, say, cosmic rays, which can in turn affect the shock jump conditions, etc.?
I don't know. This is basically something that I've essentially closed my eyes to all the idea of what's going on with cosmic ray acceleration, just because I needed to have a simple context to interpret it, and yes, there is, I'm not sure exactly how much would be lost to acceleration of and other processes besides just collisions. It's something to think about.
Okay, we'll have to close that interesting